The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
About the Buddha's teaching that's known as not-self. Sometimes popularly it's known as non-self or no-self, but that's a little bit of a mistranslation of the original. And it's one of the more well-known, perplexing teachings of Buddhism, especially when the people do say there's no self. So I thought that I would try to cover a little bit for you. And the idea is that it's meant to be a very practical teaching, and practical for the purposes of not being stressed, suffer, de-stressed by the whole kind of ways in which people hold self, not self, the whole kind of concept that swirls around this whole self thing. And I want to start by talking a little bit more the background of these teachings in ancient India, how it was back then, and then bring it into something that's more practical, and the alternative to the whole selfing concern that the Buddha was addressing. So the word that's translated as self, when you translate from the ancient Indian language of the Buddha to the modern world, is the word atta, A-T-T-A. And in Sanskrit, it's atman. Some of you have heard it there. And that word, atta, has two meanings. One of the meanings is it's a simple, innocent, reflexive pronoun, meaning you say myself, yourself, ourselves. And so when you talk about myself, then you can use the word atta as just a simple, you know, reference, you know, over here. And there's no metaphysical, meaning to the term. It's just simply, my name is Gil. Does Gil really exist, or does he not exist, or how does Gil exist? That's independent of, that's a whole other question than the question of what do people usually call me? And what names do I respond by? What name can you say that you get my attention? I can look up and say yes. So my name, you say my name is Gil, and so that my is sometimes atta. Not much to be made of it. And there's some wonderful statements the Buddha makes using that simple pronoun. He says, don't give yourself away to someone else. Don't become a slave to someone else in the ancient world, but don't give yourself away. It also said, make an island unto yourself. Make a refuge of yourself. Be a refuge unto your own self. So just kind of take care of yourself, be responsible for yourself, live in such a way that you are protected by yourself, that you are at home in yourself, that you're a refuge here. And that just kind of means, take care of yourself. And there's, many things that only you can do for yourself. No one else can do it for you. And we kind of expect that hopefully you'll, do it for yourself, like peeing. You don't ask other people to do it for you, even if you have to use a diaper, you still, you're not asking anybody else to do it for you. The peeing, just, you do the peeing. And it's kind of, you don't have a metaphysical self, you don't have this grand theories about what the self really is. If you say, I gotta go pee, that's, which self is peeing, and... And is there a real self? And I've heard there's no self in Buddhism, so, I'm not really responsible for my peeing. And, you're responsible for that. So that's pretty basic. And so there's a lot of things which are not as basic as that you're responsible for and taking care of. And so you can take that complex of things which exist here and thing that you can, that's called this name of yours, and you can, it can become a refuge. It's a beautiful thing. It's going to be a support. It's something meaningful, place to rest and be at home in. What it is, that's not the, you know, so interesting at this point. So that's kind of the innocent use of the word atta, of self, myself. When the Buddha was differentiating himself from the people who believed in an atta, an atman, as a metaphysical entity, then we translate into English with a capital S, the self. And even then, it might be a little bit difficult in English to appreciate what this is, because we use the word self so easily in English, and it has so many different meanings and has so much importance in psychology and different places. And it's probably, the word atta is probably better translated as soul, if we don't understand the soul as being a particular, like in the West sometimes we have the idea that each person has a particular unique soul, it's different from everybody else. The Atman is a universal essence that all beings equally have. And it's not nothing personal about it at all, but it resides as an essence within us. And so that idea of a permanent abiding essence is sometimes in the environment of the Buddha, some religious people were calling the Atman. And the purpose of the religious life was to realize that true essential self that's permanent. And they had a lot of different theories about the nature of this Atman, this self, what it might be, the soul. But the ones that the Buddha had the most contact with, that's swirling around him at his time, is that this essential soul thing is imperceptible. It cannot be perceived. But it's permanent and always there. And it's the true self, and if you can realize that imperceptible true self, that then there's bliss and happiness, and everything is great. And that's the purpose of goal is to attain that. And the people who believed that, same time believed that what you could perceive in the world doesn't really qualify as that essential self. The Buddha was saying, I'm not interested in that whole philosophy, that approach. And in fact, that whole idea of an imperceptible, essential, true, permanent self, to be concerned with that and interested in that, it does not lead to liberation. And what the Buddha was interested in was liberation from suffering, liberation from clinging, from the contractions of the heart. So it's a very pragmatic purpose, something that's perceivable, that belongs to the world of experience, here and now. You can experience if it hurts, if you suffer, if you're stressed, if you're contracted and tight. And you can experience what it's like to be free of that. Whether there is or is not an imperceptible, enduring self, the Buddha found it to be an irrelevant issue for this pragmatic concern of freedom. Now that's maybe a religious point of view, and different than, you know, other Indian ideas, and so when the Buddha talked about something is not self, he was generally talking about it, it's not the soul. But in doing that, he was teaching actually something very similar to the other people who said that in the world of perception, what you can see and experience, none of that is the self. The soul, your body, your feelings, your emotions, your thoughts, your consciousness, because you can be aware of them, none of them qualifies this thing, the self with a capital S. What the Buddha did, it was a little different than the others at that time, was he did not then posit that there is some essential soul. He left that part out. He just wasn't interested in that. It was enough for him to know that nothing here qualified as the soul. Therefore, people who were trying to hold on to it and cling to it for some kind of permanent sense of safety, permanent sense of like they're right, the kind of permanent kind of transcending of the world, because to attain this imperceptible self, you kind of have to leave the perceptible world and go into a kind of a altered, transcendent state. And so that wasn't interesting for him. He was interested in freedom in this world that we live in. And so if you took anything in this world as that self, it was just more clinging and attachment. So the Buddha would, for these people who are caught up in this idea, and apparently many people must have been, because he spent a lot of time talking about this is not self, this is not self, this is not self. And so his teaching is about not what's not self. And if you attach to your body as the self, or as your essential being, and you hear this instruction is not self, then if you're inclined to, you might let go of that, the clinging. If you're told the feelings are not that self, and you let go of that, then you relax that clinging. If you're told that your perceptions are not self, you relax that. If you're told that your mental thoughts and mental activities and intentions are not self, then you relax that holding on. And if you're told that your consciousness is not self, then you might relax that idea of self. And after a while, you're pretty relaxed. You know, your hands open, you're relaxed and everything. But if you're not attached to this idea of a soul, or essentially, you're not even concerned about it. Some of you have never even heard about this Indian idea before, and so, you know, it's not quite relevant for you unless you kind of extend and interpret this idea into a different context, like the Western context. And so it's very common for Western teachers to expand the notion of self to be all kinds of other ideas of self that are not the same as this ancient idea of the soul. And it gets a little bit confusing exactly what they're talking about then, because usually it's not so well defined. And it can lead to all kinds of complications. And one of them is that if you start saying too much that there is no self, or that this is not self, or something, then ordinary identities get confused. Like, what? You know, am I not supposed to see myself as, you know, some kind of identity? And then we have this problem in our society that some people's selves are denied. You know, you don't really count somehow, and you're not supposed to be a self. You're not supposed to, you know. And so some people are attached to being either suffer because they're not allowed to be a self, not allowed to be who they are, or they're somehow attached to not wanting to be themselves something. They kind of like want to be invisible and, you know, not count. So sometimes this Buddhist teachings of not self doesn't do enough justice to the possibility of living a life of powerful confidence that we are here and we can establish self and be dignified and valued and unapologetic, undefendedly just here in a clear, strong, confident way, and that we want to support people to have that ability. And when people hear too much teachings of no self, no self, no self, like they get kind of sort of shrinking and like, you know, they're not supposed to kind of show up and be. So what is this teachings? So this idea of not self in the original context had a lot to do with something to do with soul, some kind of idea. But the Buddha had another set of teaching. And to get to that's related, but it's different. And it's maybe closer to the psychological understanding that many of us feel comfortable with. But to get to it, I'd like to point to what the Buddha said was an alternative way of approaching your life than looking for a soul or an essential self or the true essential being of who we are. And that an alternative perspective. And that is to be interested in noticing, and this relates to the talk I gave last Monday about the Four Noble Truths, be interested in where you're suffering, or where you're stressed, or where you feel unease. Buddhists stop for suffering. They're interested in it. they think it's invaluable to stop and notice when we're suffering. And Buddhists, in a certain kind of wonderful, dedicated, maybe happy way or something, they're kind of intolerant of it. Meaning, they're not willing to put up with it. We're not learning to be Buddhists to suffer better. You know, accept your suffering and just like, you know, you'll figure out how to be at ease with your suffering and, you know, it's, you know, just suffering after all. And there's no self, so, you know, no one's suffering. So, you know, it's not a problem. And it's just suffering. And but there is, you know, the heart of Buddhism is this knowing this potential of not suffering and moving in that direction, having that as kind of the North Star that that supports us. And so to do that, there has to be a realistic assessment and a recognition and a tuning into suffering, not to suffer better, but to kind of be able to go through it to the other side. And then to be interested in suffering and to be interested in the cause of suffering, the clinging, the attachment that brings it about, so that we can learn how to let go of the attachment, the craving that brings our suffering. Kind of let go of some of our contribution to the way we contract or tighten up or become stressed or become somehow, you know, caught up in clinging. And then to let go of that, to free it. The result of that is to do it thoroughly and well, is to enter into a path of happiness and well-being, of ease and peace, because we begin letting go of the forces that bring about suffering. And as we develop this ease, it comes with developing a strong sense of awareness, strong sense of settledness and stability here and now, a strong sense of self-monitoring and self-awareness. What that comes with is dropping away of forces of things that are debilitating for us. It turns out that things like being shy is not a nothing. You're not doing nothing when we're shy. It's an activity of the mind to be shy. Something's going on that makes us shy. We don't, you know. And so if the mind settles and is deeply relaxed and the activity of shyness is not there, then the person is not conceited, is not then puffed up or assertive. They're just there in a strong way. If you let go of kind of conceited pride, you don't end up as a, you know, as a couch potato or as a nobody. You end up as someone who's just there again, upright, unapologetic, unassertive in some kind of conceited way, just there in a strong way, ready to look at reality directly in the eye. And the idea is, as we let go of these forces of clinging and relaxation, we come into a balanced place, or into a homeostasis around not needing to assert an identity in a forceful way, to prove ourselves, to make ourselves something, to force other people to see a certain way, or to apologize for ourselves. We don't have to disappear and pretend we don't exist. We can just be there in a clear, direct, full way. I remember many years ago, we had a meeting here at IMC about, I don't know, 12 years ago, of a group of Buddhist teachers who had been teachers, who had been Buddhist practitioners by that time, let's see, some 30, 35 years. So they'd been practicing for a long time, and senior teachers who'd been abbots of different temples around, and it was just a kind of private gathering to talk about Dharma and stuff. And in the course of that sitting around a circle talking, someone asked, what are your challenges these days? What are your personal challenges? And they went around and they talked about personal, psychological, familial, different challenges they have. Someone talked about challenges they have with the practice of Buddhism itself. And it was, in some ways, some of that stuff was kind of in the ordinary realm that many people have. And so, you know, maybe a little bit surprising that they had ordinary challenges, like, you know, after all those years of practice. But what was remarkable was the ease and relaxation in which they talked about it. They were not defensive. They were not embarrassed. They were not, they didn't feel bad about themselves for being this way. They didn't feel like they had to hide it. They didn't feel, you know, they didn't kind of think of themselves as a bad Buddhist. You know, I'm not doing it right, you know, I'm doing it wrong, and after all these years I should have been doing better. And they just like, they kind of smiled and relaxed and said, you know. I remember one person said, you know, I've been giving these Dharma talks for so long, and you know, every time before I give a Dharma talk, I'm still nervous. And the person said it with a smile and, you know, like open and like just, this is the way it is. And I thought that was quite remarkable. The ease and relaxation. There wasn't added suffering on top of it. So to come to a place, to practice and come to a place of some kind of deep ease or well-being or peace, to know that, even if it's just a short while, to know it really deeply, and then have that as a reference for how to go through our life, as opposed to using the idea of me, myself, and mine. What's mine? It's mine. This is who I am. This is me. And you better, you know, take me into account. I need praise. I need lots of praise. And if I don't get enough praise, someone's going to pay. That's how, you know, that's to live life well. You know, get the praise. Thank you. You know, or, you know, if I don't get enough praise, then I think I should blame someone, you know. You know, that's really, you know, and play the whole praise and blame game. That's sad. It's painful for oneself and for others. That's not a nice place to live in. If you don't know a place of peace and ease that's an alternative to that, then it might be easy to succumb to that old praise and blame game because that's all you know. You feel like you're safer or you have energy or more alive or you count, you have value if you're praised. But if you have a deep abiding sense of confidence and well-being just for breathing, just for being alive, then you know that's so much better than the praise and blame game. It's just not interesting to go there. Praise and blame has a lot to do with self-concept, self-ideas. And so the alternative to being caught up in these kinds of ideas is to have the sense of well-being. So it's in that spirit, in that kind of approach, that the Buddha then addressed a lot of the ways in which people suffer around their concepts of self. It wasn't to criticize something, but rather to point to something that's so much better. And so what he did talk about a lot was the suffering that comes from seeing, identifying things, holding on to things as this is mine, this is mine, this is who I am, and this is myself. And what that these terms mean, this is mine, has to do with issues of possession. This is my thing. And so we can certainly have material things that we possess, but then sometimes it's our opinions. You know, and my opinions are really important to have. It's very important that my opinions are known. How I'm seen by other people, how I'm valued is based on my opinions. And so, or my stories, or my, you know, there's things that are, you know, are mine. My clothes, you know, I am my clothes. So my clothes are really important. It's important that everyone see me with wearing these, you know, important clothes that I wear. Or my car, or my spouse, you know, I'm seen through the filter of my spouse, and that's how I get identified. And so there's a lot of suffering around possession or taking things as mine. And one of the exercises that I think is kind of interesting is to look at this issue of mine. Is many of you have put your shoes in the shoe rack here today. And if we all went home with different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. And the idea of it's, your shoe, is interesting. It's helpful. We want you to go home and not get, cramped feet because you're using too small shoes or falling out of your shoes. There's a wonderful photograph of this Zen master named Suzuki Roshi, who lived in San Francisco. And the photograph is of him leaning forward with his glasses. He's holding up his glasses about a foot away from his face, and he's leaning forward. And it was coincidentally, this photograph was taken just as he was saying something. He was holding up his glasses to show people, and he said, "These glasses are not my glasses. But you know about my tired old eyes, so you allow me to use them." It's in my glasses, stay away. Very different feeling. So this whole idea of mine is a very interesting area to look at, and there's a lot of suffering around it. And is there an alternative way of being in the world that honors ourselves, takes care of ourselves, that we can have things so that we don't suffer around them? Some people like to say that the things I have are lent to me. But you bought them. Yeah, but they're all on loan. And if I see them as being on loan, then I actually go through the world with more ease than if I go through, this is mine, I have to protect it. And I maybe told this story recently, but I'll say it again. A good number of years ago, it might have been like one of the first smartphones on the market, or just like just before this, what we call now smartphones, but like something that was almost as good. They had some kind of phone that was very expensive. I think it was over $1,000 or something back then. And there was a Buddhist monk who's a renunciant, who's not supposed to have any money, not supposed to have, wealth. And I saw him, and he had one of these back then, kind of like state-of-the-art, very expensive phones. I said, "What are you doing? You're a renunciant." "What are you doing with such a wealthy, expensive thing?" And he said, "Someone gave it to me. And I figured it was okay for me to have it as long as if someone asked me for it, I would give it to them." So for a moment, I was tempted. So I'm offering you just different ways of holding it and seeing it. That, it's the whole idea that this is mine is an important area of suffering. And so to break up the hold of the existing attitudes of possession that you have, there's another way of holding it, was one of the things that the Buddha was pointing to. So this is mine. The other is this is who I am. And this is understood in the tradition to be the suffering of conceit. So this is where we assume and hold on to, we cling to some identity, often in relationship to other people. And in English, we often think of conceit as thinking that you're better than that we're better than someone else. But in Buddhism, the idea of conceit is of three types. There's the conceit that you're superior to someone else. There's also the conceit that you're inferior to someone else. And people can hold on to that just as strongly as the idea that you're superior. And the third kind of conceit is the conceit that you're equal to others. So what's the alternative? In America, where we're supposed to all be, there's a kind of an ideal in America that we're all supposed to be equal. And I saw a great documentary this weekend called Inequality for All. And it's Robert Reicht is a documentary about The Economist, who's talking about income inequality in America. I thought it was a great documentary. But this, you know, I think he's playing with this idea of equality for all is the goal, right? But actually there's a lot of inequality. So the idea of equality is also, why it's a problem in Buddhism is that it's still playing the self game, measuring yourself against other people. And so what the Buddha says, there's an alternative to conceit when we're holding on to some idea, even the idea that we're all equal. And that is, you don't play the self game. You don't play the conceit game. You don't play the comparison game. You're just there in a confident, assured, stable way, as if you belong here, that you're, and you're able to offer that to other people too. You look upon them as if they're there, and you allow them to be there in a way they feel safe and open and present, and not you don't have to see them through the lens of your comparison and your conceit and better and worse than, and just they're allowed to be. So the whole idea of conceit, there's lots of conceits that people have which cause suffering. The third form of self is this word is this is myself. That's the suffering of views, of philosophies. And everyone in some ways is a philosopher in some way that they have sometimes, often some kind of inherited or developed from our culture or society or thoughts, some idea of what the true self is. And then some people suffer around that. People do a lot of meditation, a common kind of clinging is that awareness is the self, that consciousness is the really who we are. And so the Buddha said that there's a lot of suffering around this holding onto some view and philosophy. And now I know who the self is. I want to know what the true self is. And so to notice that suffering and know an alternative is part of the function of Buddhism. An alternative of peace that doesn't require having the answer or to know what the true self is. So the operating principle here is that there, if you're tuning in to suffering, you're sensitive to it when it occurs, then you'll notice that there's unease or suffering or stress when there is some kind of attachment around mine. The fact that you say take something as mine could be innocent and normal, and it's kind of helpful to other people if you say, you know, this, it's mine. Someone, if you you left your shoes in the shoe rack and you go out and someone's unsure which shoe is yours, and they say, which is yours? And you say, well, that's mine over there. You do them a favor. You know, it's not like I'm attached to my shoes. It's just like mine. It's easy. It's innocent. But to be sensitive to suffering, then we can feel when we're stressed or tight or contracted around what's mine. And then the point of Buddhist practice is to discover the alternative to that, how to live without that suffering. If we're sensitive to suffering, we notice how the suffering of conceit, when there's a suffering around identity and comparison with other people, some comparison's okay. Someone today asked me, can you get that from up above, pull it down? Because you're so much taller than me. That's a comparison. You know, I'm the tall and the person was a shorter person. That could be, doesn't have to be any problem with that. Or there can be a lot of problem with that. There's a lot of suffering in our society around height for some people. Today it was innocent. But, you know, if you tune into the suffering around it and the suffering people have, then we can start addressing and finding what's the alternative to it. And then the suffering of the views, of philosophy, ideas of this is my true self. If we're sensitive to the suffering of it, then we can look for the alternative. And if you know the alternative, if you've had an experience of deep abiding sense of well-being and peace and confidence and presence that's meaningful, that's nourishing, that's supportive, that is supportive of helping other people feel safe and other people feel at ease and supported, then you know a treasure. And then you can kind of begin kind of evoking that or coming back to that or working towards that or doing the kind of really good inner work of looking at yourself and addressing where you're attached, trying to understand what's going on, looking to kind of understand the conditions that are operating, looking to learn how to let go, looking to how to move into an alternative. And then beginning to find a different way of living, a living that is not founded on conceits of me, myself, and mine. It doesn't do away with thoughts of me, myself, and I, mine, but our life is not based on it. It's just we use it as a convenience to get around and kind of find our way better. So the ancient teaching of not self, as it was taught in the ancient world, is maybe not so relevant for a good number of people who come to Buddhism in the West. How it's translated or interpreted in the West is often much more interesting, much more useful, but it's not the one-to-one correspondence of the way the Buddha taught. But one way to kind of get to it is from the Buddha's way he taught is to get to it through his teachings of understanding the suffering around this is mine, this is myself, this is who I am, and this is myself. The issue of possession around self, the issue of conceit around self, and the issue of the philosophy and views around self. And chances are that if you tune into suffering, if there's issues around self that would be helpful for you to address, you'll get to know them in this way. That if you go, I've been told, that if you're a nature photographer and you go to the grand savannas of Africa and you want to take photographs of many animals, you don't want to go racing around the savanna looking for them. You go to the watering hole and you set yourself up there. And most of those animals sooner or later will come to the watering hole and you can take pictures of them. So all the important issues that you really need to address for your safety and your peace and your well-being and the spiritual well-being and freedom, all the issues you have to address will come to you if you sit at the watering hole of suffering. That's how you'll identify the issues that need to be addressed. So, you know, don't suffer to suffer more. Wake up. Pay attention. Don't kind of be so distracted and so busy that you don't notice when you feel some unease. When you feel some unease, some stress, something, that's your teacher. That's where you can find your way forward. And if you do that, then from time to time, you'll discover that some of your suffering has its roots in issues of identity, issues of conceit, issues of possessiveness, issues of, you know, these views that we hold. And then maybe you'll be interested in the alternative. And in living the alternative, I hope that you live in a confident, assured, dignified way where you understand that you and everyone else are worthy, valuable beings to be loved and cared for and respected. Because it would be really great to live in a world where there's mutual respect, mutual admiration, mutual support, and mutual love. And that's one of the alternatives to the whole issue of self and selfing, which causes so much suffering. So I hope this made a little bit of sense of this ancient teaching and case make some sense of it. And if it's too complicated, don't make a self out of your confusion. Thank you.